Deadline's Iran's foreign minister slams the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden for sticking to its predecessor's policy of imposing illegal sanctions against Tehran. Britain's hope of a post-Brexit agreement with the U.S. fades away as Washington plays down the chances of striking a free trade deal with London. And also in our headlines, Muslim pilgrims are converging on Iraq's holy city of Karbala to mark the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Iran has reiterated that talks in Vienna between the Islamic Republic and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal simply aimed at bringing the United States back to full compliance with the accord. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment as he met his German counterpart Heiko Maas in New York City on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. Amir Abdollahian said the U.S. should know that all trade-offs have already been made in the course of negotiations that led to the multilateral pact. He added that the Vienna talks are not meant to strike a new nuclear deal. Rather, they seek to ensure a guaranteed return to the U.S. To the agreement after its unilateral pullout in 2018. Amir Abdollahian also met EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. He told Borrell that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is following its predecessor's footsteps by keeping sanctions on Iran in place. The top diplomat slammed the U.S. policy as non-constructive. Now, the Iran nuclear deal was one of the topics raised by world leaders as they spoke at the 76th United Nations General Assembly session. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi addressed the session as well, rejecting U.S. hegemony and oppressive sanctions.
As the 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York, world leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern. This year, like the past few years, the fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and anti-Tehran sanctions were among the issues mentioned in the speeches. In his first address to the Assembly as the U.S. President, Joe Biden reiterated his administration's position on the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
The United States remains committed to preventing Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. We are working with the P5+1 to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to JCPOA. We're prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who was also speaking for the first time to the UN General Assembly, said Tehran has no trust in U.S. promises and noted that his country will welcome talks that would lead to the complete removal of sanctions against Tehran.
The Islamic Republic considers as useful talks whose ultimate outcome is the lifting of all oppressive sanctions. While decisively defending all its rights and the interests of its people, Iran is keen to have large-scale political and economic cooperation and convergence with the rest of the world.
He slammed the restrictions, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, as tantamount to crimes against humanity. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi said the time for exercising hegemony and violating the will of nations have long passed.
This year, two scenes made history. One was on January the 6th, when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August. From the capital to Kabul, one clear message was sent to the world. The United States' hegemonic system has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. What is seen in our region today proves that not only the hegemon and the idea of hegemony, but also the project of imposing westernized identity have failed miserably.
The Iranian president said, pursuing hegemony results in bloodshed, instability, and ultimately defeat and retreat. He noted that the U.S. isn't withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, but is being ousted. President Raisi's remarks appeared to be setting the tone for the upcoming Vienna talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA, which are due to resume over the next few weeks. Iran says it doesn't want anything beyond its rights, that is, the implementation of international law.
Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier says the U.S. is the party that needs to take the first step to help revive the nuclear deal by removing all sanctions imposed on Iran.
But the problem seems to be from the American side that they don't understand they have to move forward first before Iran, because Iran followed the lack of compliance of the U.S. and not vice versa. And the U.S. wants to see Iran withdrawing from all the steps that it has taken according to the Article 37 and 36 of the JCPOA that allow it to withdraw gradually from the deal if one of the signatory rejected its commitment. So what we need to see today is the Americans declaring that they are going to lift all sanctions, and then Iran can confirm that this is going to happen and its frozen money is going to return. The other European and non-European countries are going to be allowed to deal with Iran, and Iran can sell its oil without restriction. And when this is going to happen, then Iran has always repeated, we're not going to make an atomic bomb. And the Americans are saying, we don't want the Iranian to make an atomic bomb. So they both on the same ground, they agree on the same point. The only thing is a matter of practicality that the U.S. needs to prove its commitment.
U.S. President Joe Biden has played down the chances of inking a free trade deal with the U.K. while meeting with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson at the Oval Office. Biden and Johnson held talks on issues ranging from security to climate change, Russia and China. But on the trade deal issue, the U.S. president said they needed to work through it, confirming Downing Street's assumption that the prospect of a major pact is a long way off. London had sought a post-Brexit free trade deal in order to encourage commerce with U.S. by reducing or eliminating tariffs. According to British media, U.K. ministers are now considering joining an existing trade arrangement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The North American Trade Pact, known as USMCA, was set up after former U.S. President Donald Trump tore up its predecessor, NAFTA. The European Commission says major differences with Britain relating to elements of Brexit must be settled before the end of December. EU affairs ministers have been discussing growing divisions between Western allies during a meeting in Brussels. Our correspondent Jerome Hughes has sent this report from the Belgian capital.
As government ministers from the 27-nation EU arrived for a meeting at the European Council building in Brussels on Tuesday, it became apparent very quickly that the bloc is lurching towards a bitter showdown with some of its closest allies.
We see when we look at the Brexit agreement that they are not well implemented, that they are not fully respected. We see it with AUKUS that there were some hidden things, so it's not the best context to have trust between us.
Senior European Commission officials told the EU affairs ministers that Brexit issues relating to Northern Ireland must be sorted out before January 1st. The Commission accuses Britain of breaking its end of the deal.
We need to rebuild the trust. We are ready to do that. We are working very intensely within the Commission. We want to arrive together with our UK partners in the joint solutions.
Outside the meeting, members of workers' unions gathered to warn of further problems for the EU unless poverty and exclusion are addressed.
People are starting to lose hope a bit in the EU project, and I think the Brexit was clearly a sign of that. And I think the recipe to change this is to have a more social Europe.
EU affairs ministers agreed to seek further information on the move by the US, Britain and Australia to scupper a multi-billion euro submarine deal that Paris had with Canberra.
We definitely remain committed to cooperation with our partners on the international stage, but any new alliances that may appear, of course, raise a number of questions.
The controversy surrounding the new US, UK and Australia weapons agreement known as AUKUS has been raised with Maurice Payne, the Australian Foreign Minister.
I inquired about the reasons behind the lack of prior consultation on AUKUS and regretted that this alliance excluded European partners.
Officials tell me Borrell did not get a straight answer as to why France and the EU were blindsided. It's clear, however, Canberra was lobbied by Washington and London. At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess. Jerome Hughes at the EU Affairs Ministers meeting, Brussels.
Well, the UK has warned the food industry about a sharp rise in carbon dioxide prices after wholesale gas prices soar in the country. Environment Secretary George Austis said the cost of every ton of CO2 would rise fivefold to around £1,000. The warning came after London offered tens of millions of dollars to restart production of carbon dioxide at a US-owned plant. The CF Industries was shut recently because of soaring gas prices. The government has warned that some food producers, including poultry plants, would need to close. A leading gas distributor company has also expressed concern that the UK carbon dioxide shortage is spilling over into the rest of Europe. The continent faces a liquefied natural gas crisis as high demand in Asia pushed down supplies to Europe. Muslim pilgrims are streaming into Iraq's holy city of Kabul ahead of the Day of Arbaeen. The pilgrims are joining the annual gathering that marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arbaeen falls on September 28th. The event drew millions of people in the past years, but the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign visitors since last year due to the coronavirus pandemic. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred in an unequal battle with troops of the tyrant ruler of their time over 13 centuries ago. The battle known as the event of Ashura is one of the most important religious occasions marked by Muslims. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is facing criticism both at home and abroad over its handling of migrants massing along the Mexican border. Republicans have cited lax security, while Democrats express concern about the humanitarian situation at the border. Some 14,000 asylum seekers, majority of them from Haiti, have been camping under a bridge in Texas since last week. Several hundred have already been deported to Haiti, and thousands more have been moved into detention. The move has sparked criticism, with several UN agencies calling for an end to the mass expulsion of migrants. In a statement, the UN refugee chief said he was shocked by images of the deplorable conditions of migrants. Filippo Grandi said expulsions of individuals are inconsistent with international norms. Earlier, the UN Human Rights Office also voiced concern over the plight of asylum seekers. Three people are killed in an attack on a checkpoint in the eastern Afghan city of Jalalabad. Local sources say a group of gunmen killed two Taliban guards and a civilian in the attack. The Taliban have confirmed the attack, but said all victims were civilians. On Saturday, a series of explosions hit Jalalabad. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility for the attacks and said 35 Taliban members were killed or wounded in the incidents. The Taliban have unveiled the names of 17 figures as the new high-ranking officials and ministers of Afghanistan's government. Some locals have welcomed the announcement and called on the Taliban to form a government soon, but opponents have rejected the list as neither inclusive nor representative of Afghanistan's ethnic diversity. Amin Alimi reports from Kabul.
The Taliban has unveiled the name of 17 individuals as the newly appointed high-ranking officials for some ministries and other key governmental bodies, such as the country's Directorate of Atomic Energy. The Taliban claim they have done their best to include a number of well-educated people to the new list of the group's acting cabinet ministers.
The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan keeps trying to appoint more professional and well-educated people as top government officials in order to offer better service to our nation and strengthen Islamic governance system here.
The Taliban's move to appoint 17 new top government officials comes as the group's leadership had already pledged to establish an inclusive government. However, many here in Afghanistan believe the symbolic presence of some officials on behalf of some ethnic groups does not mean that the Taliban is trying to form an inclusive government.
We are waiting for establishment of a real inclusive government, and Taliban must accept such demand of the nation. This is because we are facing serious challenges such as joblessness and poverty.
In the meantime, the Taliban spokesman says the current government is an interim one and that works are underway to establish an inclusive government. According to the group, the future Afghan government will convince the world to recognize the Taliban-appointed government as the legitimate government of Afghanistan.
The Taliban are struggling to form their government, while the resistance front in Panjshir Valley says it will never accept the rule of the Taliban over Afghanistan unless they say yes to the main demands of Afghans. Demands such as forming a real inclusive government that does not deprive women and girls of their basic rights and paying respect to social and cultural liberties of people. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Ford India workers have held a protest rally in the western state of Gujarat over the automaker's planned closure of its car manufacturing operations in the country. The protesters demand that the company scrap its plan or they be provided other jobs. The American multinational firm announced earlier this month that it would stop making cars in India due to stagnating sales. Over 4,000 full-time workers would lose their jobs, while the impact would be extended to hundreds of car dealerships. The plant closures by automakers in recent years have worsened India's unemployment crisis. They pose a major challenge for Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who was re-elected on the promise of creating jobs. China's northeastern city of Harbin has gone into semi-shutdown following new locally transmitted COVID cases there. China's National Health Commission said three of the 16 new locally transmitted cases of coronavirus in the country were detected in Harbin. The cases have been the first local transmissions in the area since February. The temporary restrictions target indoor venues and require negative test results for commuting. Tourist sites should also limit their capacity. It is yet unclear if the new cases in Harbin are linked to the latest Delta variant outbreak in China's southeastern Fujian province. The Chinese officials have called for close attention to updates, saying the battle against the coronavirus is still a deadlock. Australians hold a third day of protests in Melbourne against COVID-19 lockdown curbs and vaccines amid heavy police presence. Police have beefed up security and pledged to prevent violent protests. Several demonstrators have been arrested on Tuesday. Over 2,000 protesters rallied in Melbourne, damaging property and injuring three police officers. More than 60 protesters were arrested. Riot police used pepper spray and rubber bullet grenades to break up the protest. Melbourne has been under lockdown for 7 weeks as it struggles to curb an outbreak of the Delta variant of COVID-19. And the continued volcanic eruption in the Spanish island of La Palma has prompted hundreds of new evacuations. More than 6,000 people have so far left the area, but no fatalities or injuries have been reported. The lava flows have also destroyed a large number of property and land. Spanish authorities warned against potential toxicities and explosions as the lava flow is expected to hit the sea. The volcano started erupting on Sunday in Spain's Canary Archipelago, shooting lava hundreds of meters into the air. The area had been rocked by thousands of tremors in the preceding days. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
holy defense, a mirror of Ashura. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The Holy Defense Week has arrived again. This week starts on September 22nd, marking the beginning of invasion and occupation of Iran's soil by the Iraqi army under the former Iraqi ruler, Saddam Hussein, an imposition of the eight-year war. The Holy Defense of the Iranian nation against the invading army of Saddam was a manifestation of the eternal epic of Ashura and the unmatched uprising of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Stay tuned, please, for the first episode of a special series on the issue. The eight-year war that Saddam imposed on Iran at the behest of his masters in Washington in 1980s is known as the Holy Defense in Iran. Although war is a reminder of destruction and death, it becomes sacred and beautiful when it becomes an arena for manifestation of lofty human values. The eight-year Holy Defense against the Ba'athist army is such a war. The youth, men and women, who sacrificed their lives in this way are the examples of resistance and steadfastness whose memory will never be forgotten. The eight-year war began on September 22, 1980, with the full support and help of the West and the East, but the two blocks of power didn't achieve their wishes of disintegrating Iran and destroying the Islamic Republic system. This war turned into a strong point and honor for the Islamic Revolution and a point of growth and flourishing for Iran. More than 250,000 of its best Iranian youth were martyred and tens of thousands of others became invalid in the war. The Iranian people proved that they had taken the example of Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura to stand firmly on their beliefs and values against the invasion of the global arrogance through its stooge Saddam. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had said earlier, "The Islamic Revolution of Iran is a gleam of Ashura and its great divine revolution." Ayatollah Khamenei says on the day of Ashura, "Look how much blessing this half a day has had in our history, and it has been alive and inspiring till this day. It is not just to be read and retell to enjoy people or impress them. It is rather the source of blessings and movement. This has been tangible in the revolution, the war, and our past history. In the history of Shiism, and rather the history of the anti-oppression revolutions in Islam, even by non-Shias, the event of Karbala has been brightly and conspicuously impressive. Perhaps it has been impressive in non-Islamic environments. In our own history, that is, the past 1,300 or 1,400 years, the very half-a-day event has been effective. Thus, it is nor strange and far-fetched. If we don't want to compare our eight-year war with that 8 to 9 hours of Imam Hussein's Ashura, or not consider it brighter than that, which this is the reality, I mean, I don't know any event in history which can be compared with that half a day. Everything is smaller than that, but this war is a scheme of that or a drop of that sea after all. Dear listeners, the lessons of Ashura have always been enlivening, moving, and inspiring. Although this event took place in a special place and time, its lessons are not limited to a certain time and place. Seeking of justice and freedom, struggle against oppression, tyranny and corruption are the outstanding lessons of Ashura. The first step in Imam Hussein's struggle is fearlessness. Superiority in number and military equipment should not cause fear, as this was fully manifested by Imam Hussein and his companions. Imam Hussein never feared the enemy's awe. The Iranian combatants during the 8-year holy defense too rushed to help the Hussein of the time, Imam Khomeini, without fearing the awe and propaganda of the enemy. They marched in the footsteps of Imam Hussein and his loyal companions with full trust in God. The Iranian combatants never capitulated to the calls of submission and preferred dignified death to life in humility. The young Iranian combatants knew it well that what could make them victorious over the enemy was their faith and trust in God and a steadfastness and unity among themselves. Martyr Mustafa Chamran beautifully depicts this in his supplication with Imam Hussein, peace upon him, when he says, "My master, I have come to fight with you against unfaith and oppression. I have come with all my being. It is Tasua, or 9th of Muharram. A huge group of Yazid's hordes are moving with a lot of tanks, cannons, armored vehicles, and many soldiers. Right and wrong have faced each other. The enemy is advancing rapidly, and I want to fight like one of your companions in Karbala." Iraq had dispatched 9 divisions to the war against Iran, and in practice, it enjoyed 12 armored, mechanized, and infantry divisions and 30 independent infantry brigades. Iraq's combat power was 8 times more than Iran. Yet, some estimates believe that it was 15 times stronger than Iran. What Saddam had never expected was the valor of Iran's combatants, who were scared of nothing and followed Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The Iranian combatants were the symbols of this part of Ayah 249 of Surah Baqarah, which reads, "How many a small party has overcome a larger party by Allah's will, and Allah is with the patient."
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight. Some 12,000 migrants, mostly from Haiti, have been staying at a camp under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas. Department of Homeland Security saying that 6,500 migrants were taken to custody in advance of processing and removal from the U.S., and on Sunday, flights started to carry Haitian asylum seekers back home. The United Nations has voiced concerns at the U.S. deportation of mostly Haitian refugees. American rights groups have also demanded a halt to the deportations. The expulsions are taking place under a health order, citing the coronavirus pandemic. Now, to begin with this, let's go to Washington, D.C. Our correspondent, Colin Campbell's there. Colin, tell us more about this migration thing and the problems.
Yes, the crisis at the border is very troubling because of the policies that the U.S. has enacted on Haitian immigrants who have walked through Brazil, through South America, to get to the border. Can you imagine walking through Brazil and then walking to the border, just some of the atrocities that you face along the way? Well, thousands of Haitian immigrants have gone through this journey in hopes of a better life in America. And this is the welcome that they received. Border Patrol agents on horseback using whips to control them. Children starving, people starving, children crying, getting out of the way of these Border Patrol agents. The imagery is very shocking as we see these people who are already in a very destitute state being welcomed by America, so to speak, in a way that would make them seem like enemies of the country, make them seem like they are invaders to the country. And right now, the Biden administration is being harangued by many who are saying, listen, you need to retool U.S. immigration policy right now because the way you're treating these Haitians is ineffable. And right now, the Biden administration has been deporting thousands of immigrants back to Haiti. When they return, they're worse or no better off than they were when reaching the United States.
This is the Spotlight. You're watching Spotlight with me, your host, Barry Zuckerman. As you see, we're discussing the migrant problem in the United States. Let me see who's joining me in this episode of the Spotlight. Okay, we have a professor with the City University of New York, Danny Shaw, who's joining us from New York. And later I'll be joined by author and political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, also in New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Danny, as you know, U.S. authorities are taking advantage of this pandemic-related health rule called Title 42 health rule, and that was made under former President Donald Trump to expel many of the migrants without offering them, you know, the chance to seek asylum. Is this what Joe Biden had promised to do while he was running in the race for the White House?
Well, I think even beyond the bipartisan issues, whether Biden increases the number of Haitian immigrants and migrants in general who are allowed to come here or doesn't, we have to get in front of this narrative and underneath this narrative that people are just coming here because the United States is so great. What exists here is the relationship between a neo-colonizer and a neo-colony. Many of these Haitians were forced out of Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. They were living in Chile. They were living in Brazil. That situation was no longer tenable, so they continued to travel north, trying to make it to the U.S. and to be met here with insults, racism, humiliation, and even whips from the Border Patrol. The symbolism is huge in terms of how the U.S. ruling class and the U.S. population sees Haiti and Haiti's people. So I think this is an important educational moment so people understand the true relationship that exists between the most powerful imperialist country in the history of humanity and Haiti, which continues to be a neo-colony in the Caribbean.
Danny, maybe you've seen those pictures of U.S. border guards using, you know, horse reins to control immigrants. Some observers say that those pictures remind them of the violence seen during the slavery times in the U.S. How do you feel when you see such scenes? Is this how the land of opportunity deals with asylum seekers?
Yeah, the land of opportunity, in big quotation marks, that's part of this mythology that capitalism and white supremacy tries to spread around the world. Those images of the whips and the patronizing tone of the racist, white supremacist tone of those Border Patrol guards also harkens back to the 1915 and 1934 U.S. military occupation of Haiti, when thousands of Marines stepped on Haitian dignity and Haitian sovereignty and tracked down the CACOs, the Haitian resistance fighters. The same thing that's happened today in the neocolon, whether it was under the auspices of the now assassinated Jovenel Moïse, or under Ariel Henry, the prime minister today, the PHTK, the party in power, continues to repress the Haitian popular movement. So Haitians are asking across the country and across the diaspora, when will we be afforded a chance to survive in our own homeland?
Okay. Now, author and public analyst for the Center for Public Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, is also joining us from New York. Good to have with us, Keaton. So the question I have for you is, there are some people who are blaming the policies of President Biden for this influx of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. What factors play a role here?
Well, with the advantage, you have to look back what's happened. It's very telling.
Sorry, I got to jump in. Keaton, we don't hear you, right? So let me just go back to Danny and give our technicians a little bit of time to see if they can fix this problem. Daniel, let our viewers hear your opinion on how President Trump's policies could be responsible for this influx of migrants.
And I would go way before President Trump or President Bush or Tweedledee or Tweedledum, two sides of the same coin. This is decades and centuries of unfettered colonialism and neocolonialism practiced on what many have called the U.S.'s backyard, the Caribbean, Central America, the entire hemisphere. The Haitian people want a new way forward. The Haitian leadership has communicated from Port-au-Prince and Cap-Haïtien their enthusiasm in seeing the message of Evo Morales going to Cuba and then to Venezuela and CELAC and Nicolas Maduro regrouping in Mexico City. The pivot of López Obrador and the Mexican leadership denouncing the blockade of Cuba. And this is what the Haitian people want. The Haitian people want integration with their peers, south-to-south development, not development based on the underdevelopment of Haiti. That's how they frame it, the development of underdevelopment. Haiti has incredible potential. It always has. It's been always punished because of its great resources under the subsoil, and of course its number one resource, the Haitian people. So the Haitian people are looking for a way forward based on the unity of oppressed people and the integration that Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, and now Bolivia and Peru have spearheaded.
Mm-hmm. Danny, there also writes groups criticizing the Biden administration. They say that the returns are inhumane, and that's because of the dire security and economic situation in countries like Haiti. Let's have your take on that.
Of course, they're 100% correct. And to hear Alejandro Mayorkas talk about how humane their treatment of Haitians was is ridiculous. It's an entire system predicated on treating other human beings as subhuman. But I think we have to go even deeper than these liberal critiques. And as I was saying, even if the U.S. were to Biden were to increase the number, the cap to 200,000 new migrants allowed in, Really, there's 10.5 million Haitians, and if you were to open up the border tomorrow because of these institutional, structural, historical, geopolitical issues, what Haitians would stay home in their homeland? And that same question goes for Dominicans and Mexicans and Salvadorians when you're talking about so many years of inequality, of exploitation, of the devaluation of a people's currency, of occupation, of sanctions, of invasion. What choice do a people have but to flee in pursuit of the stolen resources, the stolen gold, the stolen coffee, the stolen emeralds? So I think this shift in Latin America that's going to play out as we speak at the General Assembly about 100 blocks from me right now, it's going to be very important to see what happens in the next few days. I mean, Latin America and the Caribbean are again on the rise.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Keaton Mansfield back on the phone for us. Keaton, go ahead with your comments. Sorry for that interruption.
Yes, well, that's very true. As I was at the United Nations building earlier today, only an hour ago, many different groups coming together in support of fighting back against U.S. imperialism, fighting for the sovereignty of their homeland, for the rights of their own people, against those in power in the U.S. And so Biden is not living up to what he promised to be on the campaign trail, which seems to be a popular tradition for American politicians, to make promises that not only do they not follow through with, but in Biden's case, done the exact opposite, ramping up deportation, ramping up police funding, ramping up foreign intervention. It's more than anything, it's scary to see that this is the state of the U.S. political climate and the politicians that are put in place to try to represent or pretend to represent the American people. It's a shame.
Keaton, rights groups argue that Title 42 is not based on science and is actually a violation of U.S.'s own immigration laws, and they're asking the president to reverse that policy. Now, would President Biden take heed of that and reverse the policy?
I find it unlikely. The U.S. constantly violates its own procedures, protocols that violate UN procedures and international protocols. So the idea that Biden would, unless he's faced with perhaps severe retribution or severe criticism from his own internal party bureaucracy, from Democrats who are in power already, who have sold out to the system, sold out to imperialist practices, it would be very unlikely that Biden would do the 180, so to speak, and suddenly become the president that he pretended he was on the campaign trail.
Okay. Now, Danny, we had White House spokeswoman just recently announcing that the U.S. government has a range of program options and financial support in place that would assist Haitian nationals and authorities without specifying any further. What could those plans be?
Well, at the most, there'll be drops in the ocean, drops in the bucket. These are liberal band-aids that won't change anything fundamentally in Haiti. It's the core group. It's the Organization of American States and the UN acting under the auspices of the U.S. Embassy that have the final say in all things Haitian. This is an issue about Haitian self-determination. Colonialism and the neocolonialism has always been a one-armed band-aid extracting from Haiti. So for Jen Psaki or any representative of the Biden government or any U.S. government to try to project this benevolence towards Haiti is extremely hypocritical. The true benevolence would come in the form of reparations to the tune of billions and billions of dollars restored to the Haitian people for the historical wrongs that have been visited upon them by successive U.S. administrations, both Democrat and Republican.
Now, Keaton, we also have the UN Human Rights Office expressing disappointment that there have apparently not been any individual assessments of the cases of the migrants by the United States. Why shouldn't that happen?
Well, the U.S. has been guilty of human rights violations since the American War for Independence in 1776, via persecution and military removal and extinction of Native American tribes here in the U.S., or during World War II, the imprisonment of Japanese Americans, or, of course, Jim Crow era and slavery. The U.S. has a long-standing history, the United States government has a long-standing history of human rights abuses, and then the U.S. will take this, however, and then make international claims that no, China is the enemy, China is abusing human rights, Iran is abusing human rights, Cuba, Venezuela, Haiti, the list goes on and on. At this point, it seems that human rights, or the concept of human rights, has simply become a political bargaining tool for those in power, for the most powerful in the UN, Britain and the United States. So to toy with this idea that the U.S. will rightfully and thoroughly address human rights allegations, to me seems like nonsense. It would be very out of character for the U.S. state apparatus.
Danny, let's look at it from a different angle. Isn't it thanks to Washington's own policies and meddling in some countries' affairs that forces some people to leave their countries and look for better lives elsewhere, like in the U.S.? I mean, isn't it the case of chickens coming home to roost?
That's exactly correct, and not just some people, but millions and millions, if not billions. How many Libyans, how many Syrians, how many Afghans have died making perilous trek across the Mediterranean, across Asia, and in Europe, trying to find a better way. So people are going to follow capital. People historically are going to follow the very resources usurped from them. It really comes at no surprise. And this is going to continue to happen. The right-wing media blitz right now, they continue to call this Biden's border crisis, as though Biden somehow created all of this. This goes way deeper than any individual politician. This goes hemisphere and centuries deep. So it begs a much more critical perspective on U.S. foreign policy. And until there's a fundamental change in the relationship between U.S. hegemony and U.S. unipolarity in the world's people, nothing will change. And how hypocritical Biden was at the U.N. just a few hours ago talking about this no new Cold War will work with anybody. But look at the unfettered aggression against China, against Russia, against Vietnam, against Pyongyang, against any country who dares to defy U.S. unipolarity.
Mm-hmm. Keto, let's have your opinion on the same question.
Well, I was always introduced to this topic through the analogy that when someone pulls a gun, when someone has a firearm, is behind the person holding the gun, and I think that translates pretty well into immigration into the United States. When U.S. and NATO toppled Gaddafi's Libya, thousands and thousands of Libyans flee to the United States, flee to France, flee to the West, because, quite frankly, the U.S. is the only country that the U.S. cannot orchestrate a regime change in. And so it's trying to, people are trying to go to the safest place, which ultimately ends up being going to the oppressor historically and currently. And so the U.S.'s attempt to, as Danny said, that constantly pushing this aggression against China, who's attempting to build infrastructure and build hospitals and schools and put capital, put money to good use, the U.S. doesn't want that. And so any sort of pro-China or more specifically, any sort of anti-American government is going to be an enemy of the U.S. State Department, of the intelligence agencies, and in turn has got to go. It's got to be destroyed. It doesn't matter the cost of human lives. Iraq, you know, Saddam had to go no matter the cost. And so it's a historical thing. It's not even a phenomenon at this point. It is just a consistent foreign policy of the U.S. to take out anybody they don't like, no matter what the cost is.
Right. Daniel, I got one last question for you, and I want Keaton also to comment on that. And that's if you can think of any solution to this migrant problem in the United States.
Well, we can definitely think of a solution. That solution is called socialism. That solution is called reparations. That solution is called fight back, the unity of all oppressed people. Until there's a people's government here, from D.C. to Miami to Los Angeles, nothing's going to change. This system, capitalism, is based on the pillaging of people's resources across the world. That's why they've gone after Syria so savagely. Look at these cruel sanctions imposed upon Tehran and upon Caracas and Havana. And now you have further aggression against Nicaragua. And I think it's time for the American people to connect the dots that who is the aggression meted out against. Any system that does not conform with U.S. hegemony, immediately they are under the boot and under the gun of U.S. militarism.
Okay, Keaton, what's the solution to the immigrant problem?
I absolutely think there is a solution, and I've worked as a political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, and we have proposed the policy solution, which is the Sandino Zapata Economic Corridor. The United States, China, and Russia should partner together. They should invest the money that currently goes into arms manufacturing and maintaining nuclear weapons. Take that money and invest it into a sort of Central and South American Belt and Road Initiative. Build infrastructure. Build factories. Build schools and build hospitals in cooperation with the government of Central America. And then after these things are built, turn them over, turn the management and the ownership of these roads and schools and public facilities completely over to the government of that country. Make it viable for people to stay in their homeland. Make it economically viable for people in Central and South America to remain in their homeland, remain where their families have been for generations, and live a very, very good and robust life without having to be concerned about where food is coming from. Is the U.S. going to kill our president tomorrow? That's the solution.
Okay. On that note, we'll come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We have Professor at the City University of New York, Danish Shah, in New York, and author and political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, also in New York. And I've been your host, Behruz Nedefin. I'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين عليه السلام عند تناهي الشدة تكون الفرجة وعند تضايق حلق البلاء يكون الرخاء